Hey everybody, welcome back to Patriot to the Core podcast. I am Thad Forrester, and I really appreciate you listening to our show once again. Today's guest is Rob Gutierrez of the Air Force. He's a combat controller, and he's actually one of the guys that I really wanted to get on the show since the inception, since I started planning this podcast several months ago. So I'm thankful to finally get to talk to him. Rob received the Air Force Cross, which is the nation's second highest award for valor in combat, second only to the Medal of Honor. So before I bring Rob in, I do just want to ask you to go to iTunes and please rate the podcast. The easiest thing to do is just go over to that far right star and select it, and that way it'll highlight all five stars. But actually, if you just want to just give it an honest rating and maybe write a review, please subscribe to it if you haven't. I've actually been going back and listening to the episodes during my commute, and I didn't plan on doing this because I cannot stand to hear my voice recorded. I know that I do not have a radio voice or a voice meant for podcast either. But, you know, since my goal is to speak as little as possible and to let the guests do most of the talking, I guess I got through it. But I really enjoyed it. I think the guests have been tremendous, very interesting, and there's plenty of things that they've said that I've forgotten about over the last few months. So I hope you find at least half as much enjoyment in the interviews as I do, because I thoroughly am loving it. I guess the next thing is I'll just go ahead and introduce Rob. I wanted to read a section from his Air Force Cross citation. Rob is a CCT, just like Bart Dicker from the last podcast. And so Rob's going to talk about this battle that he, where he received the Air Force Cross. And I want to give a few more, maybe set this up a little bit with his part of his citation. I'm just going to read from it here. He says, during the initial assault, the team was attacked with a barrage of rifle and heavy machine gun fire from a numerically superior and determined enemy force. Sergeant Gutierrez was shot in the chest. His team leader was shot in the leg. And the 10-man element was pinned down in a building with no escape route. In great pain and confronting the very real possibility that he would die, Gutierrez seized the initiative and refused to relinquish his duties as Joint Terminal Attack Controller. Under intense fire, he engaged Taliban fighters with his M4 rifle and brought air power to bear, controlling three danger-close A-10 strafing runs and with exceptional precision against enemy forces just 30 feet away. After the first A-10 attack, the team medic performed a needle decompression to reinflate Sergeant Gutierrez's collapsed lung, allowing him to direct the next two strafe runs, which decimated the enemy force and allowed the team to escape the kill zone without additional casualties. Throughout the four-hour battle, Sergeant Gutierrez's valorous actions, at great risk to his own life, helped save the lives of his teammates and dealt a crushing blow to the regional Taliban network. So anyway, that's a section, a segment from his Air Force Cross citation. Rob's lung actually had to be inflated a second time. It collapsed a second time. And I know he also had his hearing all jacked up from at least one of those strafing runs because they were so close. But the thing is they were so precise. They were able to, I think they killed close to 50 terrorists during this battle. So it's really, I think it's a pretty incredible story. I think you'll enjoy hearing Rob tell it and just talk about maybe what he did, why he joined the military, how 9/11 angered him, just like it did many others, and how he did something about it real quickly. So I'll just go ahead and bring Rob in now. Rob, great having you with me. Thanks for joining Patriot to the Core. I've actually wanted you on this podcast since I started, so really appreciate you joining.
I very much appreciate that. Thank you so much.
I've already had a few CCTs on here, but I would be curious. I haven't asked everyone, but I would be curious just to ask you how you got into, why you wanted to be a combat controller, and what interested you about the field.
So for myself, the way it went was back in 2001. I was going to school and working two jobs, and I basically just wasn't getting anywhere, you know? And I had kind of felt at that point in my life, I tried different jobs and things like that. I tried, you know, different trades, things like that. And it just wasn't, it wasn't the fulfillment that essentially that I felt. I didn't feel like I was doing something, to A, better myself, and B, do more for something bigger than me. So, right after September 11th, at the time, that was a early morning. I was getting ready to go knock out my shift. I was a meter reader for San Diego Gas and Electric, and basically walking, and reading about 400 meters a day through neighborhoods, gas and electric meters and things like that. And I saw everything happening on TV, and I just was shocked and, angry, because I couldn't believe I had no idea what was going on, and I was just upset, So basically, I basically called into work and said, "Hey, I think I'm going to go join the military." And the shift leader at the time laughed at me, and he was like, "Ha ha, whatever." I said, "No, don't you see what's happening on TV? There's something's wrong." And he goes, "You're not going to join the military." He's like, "You need to come into work." And I said, "No, I think I'm going to go to a recruiter's office." So I asked him for the day off at that point. I was like, "Can I just take this day? I'm going to go to a recruiter and everything." And he goes, "Man, it doesn't work that way." He's like, "You either show up or you don't get a paycheck." And I said, "Okay, I guess I quit." So I quit, and I drove straight to a recruiter's office. At that point, the Army, the Navy, and the Marine Corps and the Coast Guard's offices were completely closed. And there was this Air Force recruiter, and he was kind of like bebopping into his office. And I said, "Hey, man, are you guys hiring?" And he goes, "We're always hiring." I said, "Oh, sweet. Well, I need a job because I just quit my job." And he goes, "Do you want to join the military?" I was like, "Yep." I was like, I just want to go fight. Like, if this means we're going to go to war, I want to go fight. I want to do something." And he goes, "We have a lot of jobs in the Air Force, but, not a lot of them are actually, fighting." He's like, "But we do." He's like, "Come on in." So I sat down with him. He basically told me, and he goes, "Listen, man, from this area here, I've had zero people make it through. Very, he's like, at least that I know of." And I said, "Well, what, because at that point, I'm still in relatively, good shape. Just came out of high school, continued on, sports and try to do as much as I can." And I said, "Hey, what do you got?" And he's like, "Well, I have these jobs here." And he only gave me the option of pararescue and combat control. And he goes, "These guys," and he goes, I think these guys are like the Special Forces medics of the Air Force. And these guys, he's like, "These are the guys, they land these aircraft and they do, behind enemy lines and stuff like that." And he's like, "I think they drop bombs too. I'm not sure." And I said, "Oh, sweet. I want that job." And he goes, "All right, well, you got to take this test." I go, "Okay, is it a book test or anything?" And he goes, no, it's like a physical test." And I go, "Okay." So gave me a time and date, started the paperwork, did everything, went out there, took the test, and I passed everything except I failed that swim like no other. So I was pretty disappointed. And he goes, "No, don't be disappointed." He's like, "Just, come back in another 30 days and we'll give you another one." So I basically started, at that point also, I quit school. I was working night shifts at a restaurant as a waiter. And during the day, I basically run to the public swimming pool, and because it was kind of, short on money there. So barely making a car payment and stuff like that, everything that I could have. So I basically begged the lifeguards and stuff to please teach me how to swim more efficiently. So they were nice enough to teach me. And next, passed my pass test and I was leaving. So I just, at that point, I just wanted to do something better in the instance of, I just felt the need to serve at that point, because, just like a lot of Americans saw on TV that day, it angered a lot of people. And I just wanted to action it.
Yeah, you did it, man. You really did it. I'm actually surprised that the recruiter even knew what a combat controller or a PJ was. I mean, I know he didn't know a lot, but
surprises me. He literally had one pamphlet. That was it.
So I guess I was interested quickly as a meter reader.
Yeah.
Any crazy stories with that?
Oh, where can I start that?
Okay.
So as a meter reader, you know, you're responsible for all the gas and electric meters for people's houses and stuff. So, I mean, I went from walking in beautiful multi-million dollar homes in La Jolla, you know, walking into backyards and just dreaming of like all these mansions and pools and all this stuff. And then, you know, walking into serious neighborhoods where it's, I would say, what they would call the hood. And people laugh because they're like, "Oh, it's San Diego." I'm like, "Well, there's San Diego's a beautiful place. Don't get me wrong, but there's some bad neighborhoods." I mean, I've had instances where I've pulled up to houses and I've been chased by dogs. I've been chased by people. I've been threatened because the electric bill was too high the month before. I'm like, "Hey, I don't read this meter every month. It's someone different every month." So, you know, I would just tell people, I'm like, "Conserve your energy, man. Like, you know, like turn your lights off at night or whatever the case." I've had a, cause they give you a company truck to drive around, for your routes only, that you pick up every morning. And I've had that little Ford Ranger, when it was, at the time it was rolling blackouts in California due to the heat and, electric, shortages and stuff like that. So, you know, skyrocketing bills and things like that. I had people throw bricks at the truck. I had people yell at me, vulgar language. One lady had a shotgun in the backyard, and I just said, "Okay, I'm just going to walk away." I got chased two blocks by a couple pit bulls. What else?
I knew there had to be some dogs in there somewhere.
Oh, I you know, it's a funny thing because I got bit by the smallest dog. I thought I would have got bit by a big Rottweiler or something, or, you know, who knows. And like the smallest dogs always bite the worst. They're the ones like they try to bite your Achilles off.
Oh, that's an interesting job. Yeah. Yes. Okay. So you become a controller,
mm-hmm.
And I know there's a lot in there, but maybe we'll skip forward to October of 2009, and what deployment? How many deployments had you been on prior to this particular one?
Not many. A couple deployments at that. You know, I did more other operational stuff all over the world than my previous assignment. So, man, I had a couple. I already had a couple trips, you know, out and about. So, I basically, you know, I trailed Ish Villegas is what I did. Everywhere he went, I went.
Okay.
You know, unfortunately, I didn't get as many deployments as he did. But, you know, I'm so thankful to get what I got. You know what I mean? So at that point, I was like number three or something like that, I think.
Okay. Was this your first time to Afghanistan?
No.
Okay. So the other two had been there as well?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I'm curious. I mean, this is it's an incredible story. You received the Air Force Cross for it afterwards. And can you just walk us through it? I mean, I know it was, you know, you took a bullet, your lung collapsed, you lost a lot of blood, and you were calling in air support. There's a lot more to it. Do you mind just kind of walking us all through it?
Yeah. So I had volunteered to go early for that deployment when I got to the 2-1 STS, and essentially because my wife was pregnant, so Julie was pregnant, and I didn't, you know, nobody wants to miss the birth of their child, so I asked if I could go early so I can, you know, do a full rotation and help out and still be able to be home for the baby. So they were, you know, I was fortunate enough to get that opportunity. So I left early, went out there, got sent out west. Primarily was going to go, supposedly, like Northwest and things like that, but it ended up working out for the ODA I was attached to, just because of, you know, out at that time, out west in the Northwest was like kind of like lawless country, and I would say wasn't super busy because there just wasn't a lot of emphasis on there. So, you know, there's a lot of bad guys running around, a lot of bad guys doing stuff, and it was more like their safe haven to for the enemy to like recover and rest and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Because obviously in the South and the East, and it's really really busy. So we went out there and, you know, started from scratch trying to build and things like that. We showed up to a couple fire bases out there that we wanted to build, and basically we got asked to leave by other entities, other coalition entities. It wasn't American, I tell you that. So, and that was, you know, who knows why they just didn't want us there. So we went back and, to Herat, started working, you know, cause we find work, you know, go find work. So, we out and started looking for work, looking to try to get out there and try to get things done.
So at this point, up to this point, had it been very uneventful?
Yeah, it was actually really, you know, uneventful, where a lot of things could have happened. It just never happened, you know. Traveling all over the place, looking, and everywhere you go, there's something, you know, starts popping up, you know. The Taliban and the other enemies out there would start talking, saying, hey, who are these guys? It's all on their communications and stuff like that. And we were listening to everything. So, you know, it just didn't happen. Like tons of times the threats were coming. I'm like, all right, here we go. All right. This is, you know, game on. Let's do this. And the guys I was with that ODA were awesome. So they were all for it. Like, hey, here it comes, and let's get to work, you know, let's start getting rid of some of these bad guys. And, they never pulled the trigger on us, you know what I mean? So at that point, it was pretty uneventful. And then we started picking up some more work in the local area and other places. And we had been out working hard for about a week straight, came back, and then bam, this target popped up. They said, hey, you know, target of opportunity. It's a pretty significant target. He's about 8 kilometers to the, 8 or 9 kilometers to the north of us, and we're the closest asset, so they want us to go. So, all right, so we start planning. They said, when are we leaving? And they said, nightfall. I was like, okay. I looked at my watch, and it was already like 6:30 p.m. And I was like, oh man, it's about to get dark real quick. So I just did my thing, started, you know, going to work, putting all my requests in and everything like that, and planning, went straight into planning, putting my request out, you know, hoping for the best.
And air assets requests
and things like that, hoping they'll come out and support us, because we're leaving with or without them, and they'll show up eventually. So sent that all out, we planned up, and then we, you know, decided what we're going to do, started watching everything, doing everything, figured everything out, and started moving out that night. So it literally got dark, loaded up the trucks with our partner force, started moving out, because that area had a real heavy internal early warning network, in which they were really efficient at letting people know when foreigners are in the area or U.S. forces were anywhere near. So we didn't want to give it up. So we decided to drive up to a certain point. We only drove like a couple kilometers, and then dismounted from our vehicles, and then started walking into the village. So probably about 4 kilometers away, we got out and started walking. And another thing, we didn't really want to walk in that village because other U.S. forces had gone into that area and got blown up every single time. Nobody wants to get blown up. So
yeah. So were IEDs a concern while you were walking into there?
Absolutely. So, well, they were just so strategically placed in that village in that area was really sympathetic to the cause for them. So they had a lot, and it's not something that you could really truly defeat with electronics or anything like that, because a lot of it was called it was command debt. So basically they'd hide an IED somewhere. You didn't know where it was at. It was run into a line, and the only way the IED would go off is if someone initiated it from somewhere else. So you just never know at night whoever's watching you or whatever the case. And if you happen to walk down the, you know, the alleyway, and they ignite it, there you go. You know, it's going to go off. So, so obviously using the night as our cover, and speed and darkness is your friend at that point. We started moving out fast. So once we got into the village, we started moving out, basically rushing as fast as we could. And we didn't really want to zigzag because that takes up a lot of time. So we just basically A to B, B to C, C to D, you know, and D to E to the target.
And Rob, at this point, how much weight are you carrying yourself?
For myself, man, this deployment, you know, I had a heavier load because it was, I just didn't know what the norm was out there. So, man, I went in with a way heavier load. I probably carried at least, you know, 8 mags, water, food, my equipment, you know, 2 radios, a VDL device, you know, a couple frags, smoke, whatever, you know, because they're like, oh, why would you carry smoke at night? I'm like, well, you never know. You might be fighting until the morning and then you need it. So, and then I carried a small backpack with extra mags, water, you know, med kit, an additional 40 mic micronade launcher with some ammo just in case, in case you fought into the morning or whatever the case, because you just never know. Because I've been in fights that started at night and didn't end till the next day, you know, midday or in the afternoon. So it's always better to prepare and be ready than nothing. So so I'm probably with kit plates and all that stuff. And I wore side armor too, so which I usually don't, but that's probably total. I probably weighed at least, I would say, like 300 pounds probably.
Wow.
And yes. I'm 205 standing, so.
Yeah, so you had almost 100 pounds extra on you. Wow. Okay.
So, it was good. It was some good weight. You know what I mean?
Awesome.
I felt bad for Mike, so. Guys kind of dragging me out, so. we basically, I had some air assets on station, give me updates. They knew the route that we were taking. They knew everything, so. They advised us of what was going on the target, and essentially we could see everything. Everything appeared to be as we thought it would be. We knew the target had usually carried like a, you know, 12-man force with them sometimes. Those numbers kind of, you know, varied depending on him. So we're like, okay, we have our own assault force plus, you know, our 8 to 10 partner force that we had came up to the last cover and concealment point. I checked everything, was getting information from the aircraft. They said, yep, they had roving patrols basically around the compound area. They had guys on the rooftop, and they weren't real active, so that's why we decided to move and went for the breach. Breach went off, and that woke them up. They went, you know, the first portion of the assault force basically came in, because I was always with the ground force commander, and me being right next to him is my job. So as much as I wanted to be up front and be awesome, you know, I got to stick to reality and do my job and be right next to the ground force commander so I can get his, give him as much information and everything as needed. So, Breach went off and gunfire started. First assault force goes running in. We start, you know, moving to try to get into the building. We got nods. We're moving around. They're starting to shoot from the rooftop. And right when I was moving towards the door, I had one of the interpreters next to me, and he started firing down the alleyway, moving into the building. I looked up that way and I saw a guy roll out of a door, what appeared to be like a long stick, and I'm like, kind of like, oh crap, this guy's got a heavy machine gun or something like that. So I just start, you know, shooting down that alleyway, and another guy rolls next to him with what appeared to have like a lot of ammo. So we're shooting, putting some fire down so he wouldn't let that heavy machine gun go. It was funny because it was the wall, right, that stuck out from the doorway, and it had a metal stake, and there was a cow attached to it. So, and I heard gunshots. I could hear them, but I just didn't see where the impacts were going. And I kind of like hid behind that. I took cover with the interpreter behind that little short wall. And that thing had to have been like only like 4 feet. So, and I'm not a tall man, so I got real low behind that, and I couldn't hear anything. And then I just hear the cow like, you know, and man, that guy was, he was letting his gun rip, but it was all impacting that poor cow. So, you know, step back, return some fire. Essentially eliminated that threat. I look back and I was listening to the radio calls and stuff like that. And then, I look back and everyone, like, the warrant officers in the doorway, like waving me like, hurry up, come in. So I'm basically with the interpreter by ourselves outside the door. And I tell the interpreter, go to run to get in. And I was trying to cover him. So he goes running in, and I start running in the trail, and there's like, you know, gunshots ricocheting like on the floor and stuff I had near me. And I'm like, oh man, I totally forgot there's two dudes on the roof, that I saw. So we go, I mean, the combat chassis, man, I can pick up speed like a Ferrari when I really need to. So I started moving out as fast as I could. I pretty much caught that interpreter. And I go inside and start getting updates from the aircraft and what's going on. And we start maneuvering. You know, the target had basically moved from that location based on what we had. And it appeared that he moved to the building next to us where all the gunfire was coming from. The amount of volume of fire started picking up a lot more, and we're in the, you know, in the doorway trying to defend, and the aircraft's basically telling me, hey man, I got, you know, the number basically doubled from what it was before. All these fighters started coming out the first floor of that like two and a half story building that they had, and they just started, I mean, rushing out. So you know, they're making a decision what we want to do. Okay, we're going to maneuver out. We wanted to depart from the north of the building because the building was a square. There was an alleyway that went west to east, just to the south of it. And we wanted to go out a door to the north and then head out the tree line, or move into the building next door out that north door. Well, it had turned out they bricked up the door, so they had bricked it up, and we wouldn't have been able to get out. So the only way in was the only way out. So really, we just held security, started making calls. At this point, I didn't know yet, but the ground force commander had been shot in the leg, he was being treated. So I started looking over the warrant and saying, hey, what do you want to do? You know what I mean? Because the team sort of started working stuff and making sure security was up and, you know, was getting treated and everything. And at that point, you know, probably the first RPG hit the rock the side of the building. That's why I was like, oh man, this is getting a little hairy. and they started throwing like hand grenades on the rooftop. So,
so at this point, did you have any backup, or was it just your team? You had nothing coming and nothing in the air.
Nothing in the air, but I mean, we're at this point, we're in such close proximity. I mean, we're literally probably like less than 10 meters from these guys fighting.
Okay.
Even if, you know, at that point, it wasn't, air couldn't have done anything for me anyways, you know what I mean?
Yep.
So I'm giving updates to the ground force commander, telling him, hey, what's going on, things like that. I'm still trying to hold security in the doorway with my warrant officer. Is there some frag that comes? He turns, and because he's trying to reload, and, you know, he's out, or he was out, or he had a jam or something like that. So we never want to give up, like, you know, security in a hard spot. So I pulled him out of the way so he wasn't basically in the open doing it, you know, moved him out of the way, and I, you know, stood in front of him, put my rifle out, was listening to the aircraft, trying to get more updates, figuring things out. I had another platform overhead that was basically telling me, hey, you got multiple fighters coming from the east, you know, and they're moving out. It's not just like, you know, two or three, there's multiple fighters coming. So I'm giving the updates and trying to figure out what we want to do. And then, I wanted to get better. I say what was going on. So, and figure out, like, cause from the door where I was at, it was hard to tell where the fire was coming from. So basically stepped out, you know, took a leap of faith, stepped out, saw the threat, saw a guy up there on the rooftop, you know, shot him. And then there was another long barrel that came out of that, literally. So I was probably maybe like 7 meters from those guys, pointing directly up, you know, because it's like a 20-foot wall.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, I'd say 20. They're pretty tall, so about 20 feet. And then the other barrel shot that. But, man, at that point, I didn't know that I had already exchanged fire with that guy when I shot him, that he shot me. So took the other shot, and then it just was, you know, figured everything out, looked, and I was like, okay, I know what's going on now. I know where the most heavy volume of fire. There was like, and they're known for Afghanistan for having like these spider holes all over the walls, because we were trying to figure out where the hell, you know, where the heck all the fire's coming from, and they had these little spider holes everywhere, and they were just shooting through, and it was impacting the walls, everything, and guys were like, man, we're trying to pin down where the fire's coming from. So at that point, luckily I didn't get shot one of those.
So is there any lighting? You know, rooms, I don't know. Any lights at all? Okay, so there's moonlight or stars or just very
little? There was some good ambient light, but, you know, completely under nods. Everything's shooting under nods, under MVG. So they probably saw us just because they're so used to seeing at night, you know?
Yeah.
So at this point, you know, I figured everything out. I'm like, okay. And then, like, man, I just had this overwhelming, like, just thump of pain. And I'll be honest, it kind of like dumped me on the ground. It put me to my knees. So, and I was like, man, at this point, I was like, this sucks, you know? And at that point, I was kind of like trying to figure everything out, but I was kind of overwhelmed because I had more calls coming. Basically, and I was going to try to say something, but when I knew something was up, because I was on my knees, and I went to push my PTT. I pushed to talk to say something, and the minute my mouth opened, I just had a ton of blood come out of my mouth, and I could feel it in my gloves, because I learned a trick from Ish Viegas. I cut all my fingertips basically off my gloves, so I had protection in my hands, my fingers, so I can have dexterity to write and do stuff.
Yeah.
And I put my hand on my mouth, and I had all this blood coming out my nose and my mouth, and I didn't know why, and I was like, what just happened? And that, boy, I'll be honest, you know, I got kind of scared. I got scared at that point. I was like, damn, you know, because at that point, I didn't feel like anything had shot me dead on in the chest or in the legs or anything where I would have figured, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I just had this excruciating pain like in my arm, in my armpit, and in my my back. And I was thinking to myself, man, I got shot in the armpit. And I was pretty upset. I was more angry than anything else, to be honest. So I was pretty angry, you know, because I figured, man, I had a good friend of mine that got killed in action in eastern Afghanistan through an armpit shot, and it went through and it hit his heart. And he bled out in like 3 minutes, maybe less. So I figured, well, you know, if this is the plan, then this is the plan, you know. But I'm gonna do everything I can for these guys and to take the fight of the enemy before I'm done. So I honestly got up for a second, and then my body just like boom, fell again. I yelled for the medic, which is, his name was Mike, and I was like, Mike, like that. And he ran out, grabbed me, dragged me right back in the, let me drag myself in the building. And I basically pulled my rifle and just started holding security, like trying to, you know, hold down the backside so he would be covered as much as he could with my right arm. Cause my left arm kind of just went limp. It literally went limp. He pinned me up against the wall real quick. Once I sat up, basically he pinned me against the wall and he started talking to me. He's telling me, hey, what's going on? At this point, I really want to talk to him, but I cannot. I have this feeling of just my esophagus and my whole throat, everything was being crushed, and I was super short of breath. And I've got two F-16s, another aircraft overhead, and then another set of aircraft checking in, all calling me, and I can't say a word. I'm trying, but I can't. So
you're thinking clearly still.
Yeah, I'm still thinking clearly. I'm like, man, all these guys are calling me, and I already know these F-16s are low on gas, so I just need to start talking because I need to tell them something, because at some point they're like, what's going on, you know? They need to know. Because they're overhead and they can see it. And they're like, hey, they were reporting, hey, we see multiple muzzle flashes. What's going on? How can we help? They're calling my call sign over and over and over. And I just can't talk. So, not that I didn't want to. I just couldn't. I literally couldn't talk. So, at that point, I told Mike, he was like, point to where it hurts. And I can take my right arm and I pointed towards my throat and my chest. And he started, you know, trying to take all my kit off, and I was like hitting his hand like off my radios and stuff like that, because you had to basically take my radios out to pull my vest, and I was like, no, don't do that. So he figured out that, you know, because he could hear me being short of breath, it was just like the mm-hmm. real trying to catch a breath. He knew what was going on, so he basically, you know, under his own NVGs, he's looking at me. He basically pulls the top of my kit, my armor, pulls it out just enough where he fit his fingers down there, and then he stuck me with a needle for the needle decompression. And he goes, man, he told me up front, man, this is going to hurt, but it's going to make you feel better. And I was just like thinking to myself, it can't be any worse than this. But he was right. That needle hurt like heck. I tell you that, because that thing is about as long as, I don't know, that thing's like probably six inches long, probably. So
yeah, that's an awful visual to think
about. Oh yeah. So he stuck that thing in me, and literally within a couple, like probably within another minute, I was fully breathing on my own. Like, okay, like I can take more deeper breaths and actually talk. At that point he's like, how you doing? I said, I can breathe now, thank you, you know. And I was telling him where I was hurt, and I was like, don't take my kit off, because my radios, I need the radios, the aircraft are calling. So I started going back to work, started working it, gave SA, F-16s were like, man, we're out of gas. And I said, hey, man, I need a show of force. And I told him as low as possible from south to north, you know, just go ahead and report it and knock this thing out. So
are you laying on the ground at this time, Rob?
F-16. Show of force, probably like literally under 100 feet flying. It shook the area so bad. Guy basically fell off a roof from that those F-16s with their show of force, because they were awesome, because they were out of gas and that's all they could do. at that point. So a flight of A-10s checked in. I still had my other assets giving me essay what was going on. More insurgents were like surrounding the area. Literally, I'm having a conversation with a ground force commander because I got one guy telling me, you need to drop a bomb in the building. I looked at him like, man, we can't do that. We do that, we'll all die. Like, we'll all die if I do that. So I looked at the commander and I was like, hey, we'll just call him Captain Ryan. So, and I was like, hey, Captain, I was just like, here's what we can do. I was just like, I'm going to recommend. I got 8-10s that just checked in. They know where the target is already. I've already just got a brief with them. I got the other air asset basically marking the target right now, giving them SA. I will do a match, make sure we're on target on the same target. And I told them I recommend, since we're so close, I was like, I recommend a high-angle strafe, 30-millimeter guns. Because the other guy's like, can you just put a rocket in there? I'm like, you put a rocket, that frag is probably going to hurt one of us. Like, there's going to be fratricide. So he goes, approved. And he gave me his initials, RVK. And I said, all right, I'm doing it. So got back on the mic. Mike, at this point, I got back on the radio. Mike, my medic, had still been like packing me up and zipping me up basically and making sure I was good to go. I started, talking to the A-10s, gave him the lowdown, let them know what was going on, proceeded with my nine lines.
So all this time the medic is still working on you?
Yeah.
Okay.
So he's like, hey, you want some medication? I'm like, no. I told him we had briefed before. I said, man, if I ever get in a real bad jam and I'm like dying, or if I'm shot real bad or whatever, don't give me morphine because I won't be able to control aircraft. I'll be worthless. So he's like, all right. And it was like our own deal. So essentially at that point, talked to the A-10s. They said, all right, we'll do it. Understanding that it was such close proximity, less than 10 meters. So, I don't know, about 30 feet. They gave the run-ins real simple, gave and said, hey, we're coming in 30 seconds in from his directions, had his restrictions. And I trusted in them. So, cause they knew we had an exact match of where the target was. So, first pass was awesome. My medic Mike basically like shielded me. Unfortunately, like my left peltor was off my ear, but my helmet was still on. And first one came through, gave the clearance for number two. Number two came in hot the same way, kind of ruptured my ears real bad at that point. And then the captain had been patched up. He could barely walk, but they're walking with him, and he said, hey, we're beating feet, so all right, we're coming out the best way. And he asked me, we all basically lined up against the wall inside, and he said, hey, give me another strike and we're going to use it as cover. I said, all right. So we did another strike. It was spot on. And man, that guy pickled off like over 800 rounds at that point. I think it was like almost, I guess, like 850 or something like that.
Dang.
And it was brutal. It was harsh. Crushed that building. And then we beat feet right after. And I said, hey, we need cover the whole way out. So we started moving to the next point, which would be HLZ. And like while we're leaving, I could smell like the burning of the whole build. I could smell and I could feel the heat. It was so hot and so many explosions because they had so much ammonium nitrate in there to make IEDs and stuff like that. It was just melting that place. So we started leaving, and I can't really walk straight because my ears are real jacked at this point because my ears have been basically blown out. So Mike had basically held my back, my plate carrier, with his arm. We had basically kind of like, held up my arm and not in a tourniquet fashion, but like had it wrapped, and I basically slung my rifle right across that like a support piece for so I can hold security. And we beat feet and we're moving to the first HLZ, and we requested for that one there, and we got basically denied because they said it was too hot to go land. So they said you got to go to, you know, the secondary one, which was like a click and a half to the south. So it was a little over a click and a half. So, you know, it's probably like 1.7 maybe kilometers. And, you know.
That had to be a little demoralizing or something to know you had to walk that much further.
Oh, you should have heard the curse words. Some of the guys plus the captain were like, are you, you know. It was, hey, man, that's what they said. We got to go. So, the you know, the captain was like, yep, we will move. And then he was, you know, credit to him because, A, he's the one that gave me the permission to go through with the strike. It's his men. It's his team, you know, and it's his name that's on those rounds. So he did that. And then the second thing, he was like, nope, they're not going to approve it here. Fine, we're moving. So we, you know, like he says, we're moving. So we started moving. You know, some fire here and there, defended this and that, all the way to you know, set it up. At that point, you know, Mike, I've already fallen like 4 or 5 times because I don't have really good balance at that point. And I fell in all kinds of crap and stuff like that in those areas. And it's just dirty. So I get to this wall where we're going about to set up the HLZ. And because the medevac platform that wanted to pick us up had to have the specific way to markings at night because they weren't American. So they had to have a specific setup with IR chem lights in a specific manner measured out. So I already knew that. So basically, went out and did that with security, and Mike went out, set up the HLZ, came back. And then, man, I just had this like feeling again of like, I couldn't breathe. And Mike basically pushed me up against the wall and he's like, hey, we're gonna do it again. Okay. And I'm like, all right. So he stuck me again, opened me up, good to go. And then, he put me in the northeast corner of that HLZ. Basically, at that point, I started freezing, all kinds of stuff and everything. He was trying to keep me alive, basically, because I was still bleeding. I had an upper gunshot wound in the left arm that just kept bleeding. And, man, I was just like in and out, you know, until finally they called and I got him in, had him land. We loaded up all the wounded, plus myself. I handed over control to the team sergeant through the A-10s that were giving them, because they still had to walk like – they still had like a three-click – or like a two-click walk through that village, walk out. So – and they had armed escorts from some attack helicopters and two and stuff like that. So that's really in a nutshell. Next thing I woke up for a little bit – in Herat Airfield at the hospital there, and then I was out, and I only woke up because they were giving me a chest tube, so and because that one hurts more than a needle decompression. And then after that, I woke up in Bagram and I saw a lot of guys from the 2-1, you know, I saw Mueller, you know, he came to see me, mm-hmm. And a whole bunch of my guys and stuff like that. And then literally, you know, I had my escort was at the time Captain Andrew Bear, and he was my escort the whole way, and he was awesome. So all the way to Walter Reed through Launchstuhl and everything like that. I mean, he got yelled at for getting me pizza. The lady that was working in the hospital there, I was getting MRIs and all kinds of stuff done, and he asked me if I wanted anything, and I said, man, he's like, you want some pizza? And I'm like, man, I want some pizza, you know, because I'm basically like just they're just keeping me up and running for the flights and stuff like that. And I'm more or less resting all the time, but he went out and grabbed me some pizza and brought me back and he got in trouble. So that's pretty much it right there.
So what I wanted to ask you, after you, you took the first needle, mm-hmm. and then the medics kept working on you and you were talking to the aircraft, were you laying down, sitting down, or were you standing up at that time while he was still working on you?
He was working on me, and I was basically sitting down on my butt with my feet out. My back was against the wall and basically had turned me where he could only see my left back in area. is where he had that opened up. So
okay. So what was the final assessment? What were your all your injuries?
So gunshot wound to the upper left arm, tricep, shoulder, cracked my scapula, broke three of my ribs, collapsed my lung twice, and just left me like two softball size holes in my back. So, you know, some nerve stuff here and there, but.
Wow. So how many enemy were killed that night?
So they, at that point, over 47. And then the Taliban commander that we were going after, the high value target going after, he died. He died from those, A-10 strafing runs. And on top of that, they had estimated there was like a couple thousand pounds of ammonium nitrate that were used for IEDs were all exploded. And then literally the next day, because he was killed, the next day, that same team went out and they went with another team and they captured, actually, they killed the number one Taliban commander in the area. And then essentially over 200 Taliban fighters had basically surrendered right after that.
Boom.
That's awesome. Winner.
Did you, were you shot, did your helmet take a gunshot as well in this battle?
No. Okay. Just a whole bunch of like probably like frag or whatever the case, but
okay. So you received
my nodule cracked, so I don't know what happened there.
Yeah, that's just a crazy story. And at some point later, you received the Air Force Cross.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I know, you'll have to correct me. There are, I guess it's in. Is it just in special tactics, or all of the Air Force four men? Four people have received the Air Force Cross.
Well, within Special Tactics, there's eight now. So there's within from Afghanistan, or at least since 2001. So you have John Chapman, you have Jason Cunningham, and then you have Zach Reiner, myself. Then you have. Ivan Ruiz, who's a PJ.
Uh-huh, okay.
And then you have Dustin Temple from the 2-1 as well. So that's six. And then also you got to give credit to, you know, because it wasn't towards Afghanistan, but in Somalia there was a PJ that received the Air Force Cross as well, Tim Wilkinson. And
was I'm he with Mike Durant?
Of course, there's Barry Crawford.
Yeah, okay.
So that's eight.
So I was talking to Bart Decker last night. Mm-hmm. And I was telling him I was trying to get Mike Durant on here from Black Hawk Down. And he said, yeah, there were some PJs and CCTs with him too. Is that who, was that the battle that the PJ was at that you mentioned a second ago?
Yep.
Okay.
Actually have his book, Mike Durant and the Company of Heroes. It's a great book.
Good. I've got it on my wish list, so I'll be getting it. So that's good to know.
It's an inspiring book.
I've reached out to him, so I'm hoping to talk to him at some point. Maybe he can be a guest on the show. He lives in Huntsville, Alabama, and has a company there. So that's why I was hoping maybe we could get together.
Mm-hmm.
I know you've been honored in many ways, Rob, and you know, I've seen a picture of you with President Obama, and I think it was the Oval Office.
Correct.
Okay. Is that because of the Air Force Cross, or what brought that on?
No, that was literally like 2 months before I deployed.
Really?
It was an engagement with another ODA from the previous year's deployment, and basically speaking to Senate and House members on, you know, the needs of SOF and why we need support, why we need helicopters, why we need more equipment, why we need all that stuff, basically explaining them, you know, why we need it, why it's important, why these programs are so important, you know what I mean? So,
okay.
And then they just happened to say at the last minute, like, we're going to we're going to stop at, I think it was like 1600 Pennsylvania. And at that point, I was so starving at that point. I was like, where's that? Is that like a Taco Bell or something? And they're like, everyone looked at me all funny. I'm like, what? I'm just hungry. yeah, it turns out there's no Taco Bell at 1600 Pennsylvania.
That's funny. Then, so Secretary of Defense Panetta invited you to the 9/11 memorial.
Mm-hmm.
Was that after the Air Force Cross?
Correct. Okay. So that was after, it was, I tell you what, that was a, you know, everything I had basically, you know, thought about why I joined and everything like that. It all came to the crossroads of like looking at that memorial, because we actually saw before it opened, and I got to go, you know, to the basement, to Ground Zero and things like that, and see everything, the original, you know, of like nothing, some of those places and parts that hadn't been moved and stuff. And it was beautiful, to see what they were building from there, you know? It was just, it struck a tone, and it made me feel like, you know, that I had done what I had wanted to do, and do something for something bigger than me, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So what has life been like for you since, I would say, I mean, since the, have you deployed to combat areas since that one?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. I am curious, you know, how have you adjusted, you know, from back to family life? Because I'm guessing, I don't think you're deploying now, right? You're staying. Are you staying?
No, right now I work at the AETC Air Education Training Command at the new Battlefield Airman Training Group, and I am in the Standardization and Evaluation Office for our combat controllers through the pipeline and the instructors in the schools.
Oh, okay. So what's life like for you now compared to the days when you were, you know, running and jumping and shooting?
You know, it's a little bit different. It's just a different, it's a new world for me. Every day is a good day, you know. You know, just I wake up, you know, give thanks, you know, go about my business, try to go to work, try to help out where I can, try to do the right thing, and take care of our people. Take care of our men, keep the pipeline healthy, and go about my business, and just try to, you know, do what I can from this position, you know. You don't always get to pick where you go. Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. And I was very fortunate to get this assignment because for some other needs within my family. So I'm blessed, and I can't say, you know, anything bad, you know. It goes down the path that you're given, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, you know, I take it as nothing that I can't handle, because I got faith, and faith tells me, you know.
Yeah.
Through God that, hey, man, you know, he ain't going to give me nothing I can't handle. So I was put here for a reason to do that. And then, hey, man, we're here.
Yeah, it's good. It's true. Have there been any negative effects from any of your deployments?
You know, I don't truly believe that you can deploy and you know, at least in our spectrum, I don't think that you can deploy and not have negative effects in some manner, because, you know, the things that our guys see across the spectrum, you know, it's just, you know, because in the U.S., you're so used to everything being safe, everything being nice, everything, you know, you see poverty and things like that, and you want to help or whatever the case, but it's a whole different ballgame over there. Like in all these third world countries and places, war zones that we go to, and our people are, our guys are at, I mean, you just see so much. Life is so different. And to them, this is what I believe. Life is not as valuable to them as it is to us. Life to them is just you know, it's essentially it's disposable. We don't believe that here in the U.S. or within ourselves and our culture and things like that. So, you know, they're probably, you know, some guys probably got memories and things like that, and you know, it'll stick around. But you know, I believe in our guys that they're strong enough and resilient enough to take care of it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
With themselves, or if they seek help, or whatever the case. You know what I mean? You know, it's impossible to go through all this stuff and never think about it.
Yeah, I'm sure. Has it affected your home life at all?
So one good thing is, you know, especially being at places like the 2-1 and all these other places, you learn to be resilient and things like that. You know, when something's up, you know, when something's down, and you know how to take care of it. You know what I mean? Cause I had, you know, when I was at the 2-1, I mean, you met him too. You know, I had Mueller, and I talked to Mueller all the time.
Yeah.
I had Brad Mauzy, who was awesome to help me out. Cause he was able to go, "Hey man, you know, point things out with his experience." You know, he was able to point things out. He's like, "Hey, let's take care of this." I'm like, "All right, cool." So he helped me out. And then of course I had Barry Crawford, and Barry was awesome. Helped me out. I talked to Barry probably at least once a week. You know, some things have affected me, but you know, I've already figured out at this point now, I've figured out how to handle it and how to be, you know, turn it into a positive. So.
Yeah, it sounds like you've got a support group, you know, to help you, and guys that have been through very similar situations.
Yeah, and then I always let people know, like, man, all my guys, no matter what, you know, they all have my number. They can call me anytime.
Yeah, that's great. Well, Rob, we're running up on an hour, and there's several other things I'd like to talk to you about, but I guess we'll not let it go on too much longer, but I've really enjoyed it. I appreciate you sharing a very small piece of your time in the military and really just, you know, showing how you are a patriot to the core. I mean, you epitomize what this podcast is about. I know in 2010, actually like less than a month after Mark was killed, you were part of the team that walked from Lackland Air Force Base to, I guess to Hurlburt Field, 800 and something miles, and you carried a baton with Mark's name on it, and our brother David joined you the last few miles, so we appreciate you doing that. And I know
my
you
honor.
And you came to Hayleville that year in May and walked the 30 miles at that time walk, and I know my brother David was with us, and he was very angry. You know, he hadn't prepared, and he was in pain, and you helped encourage him. I know y'all finished right there together, and so it's probably good to have your. I'm sure he appreciated your support there beside him, because he was not a happy man there towards the end.
I remember.
Well, what would you say, or how can people find out more about you? I mean, I know there's some books, and maybe you could mention some of the books that you're in, and maybe there's something else that I'm not aware of.
You know, most of the stuff, I don't really pay attention to, or I'm just so busy doing other things. I'm trying to be, you know, positive and different effect. I vector, like, if I do get any attention, it's like, hey man, you know, I let them know. I'm like, first of all, I always tell them thank you very much, because I'm very humbled and honored to, you know, to whatever's happening. I'm like, I thank you so much. And then usually I try to vector it in the direction of, you know, that people, I mean, I truly wish the public could know, but you know, obviously business is business for us. But there's so many guys out there, you know, so many combat controllers out there knocking work out. They're just doing amazing things. And you know, it's not public or anything like that. It's known internally, like, you know, between the units or squadrons, guys, things like that. They read about it, know about it within each other just from reading sit reps and blah, blah, blah. But I mean, there's just so much going on that if you think about it, my stuff is just like a dime in comparison, like a dime's worth in comparison to, you know, a lake of information that's out there, or the significant actions that are being done by young men every day, you know, things like that Mark did, you know what I mean? Guys like Danny Sanchez, Johnny Yelich, Ish Villegas, Matt Mueller, Barry Crawford, Brad Mozzie, you know, and the list can go on and on and on, you know, Bobby Bonello, all these dudes that went out and fought for their country and did great things, you know what I mean? And it's not, it's just not public, you know?
I know.
And I usually try to vector him like, hey, man, you know, like I said, I tell him, thank you. I truly appreciate it. I'm blessed and thank you. But, man, I turn it into like, did you know we have this? Did you know our guys do this? You know? And they're like, oh, okay. And then essentially you take that information and I give it to them and I tell them all about special tactics and, you know, how they can help and what they can do for our organizations and families and things like that. And that's what we try to, that's how you, you know, use what you got to make it better for everybody else, you know, ultimately for all our, like the brotherhood, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a, one of the guys you mentioned who's a friend of both of ours. He's one of those I was thinking of when you were just now speaking, how, you know, he's never had a, you know, a big time injury, never gotten a big time, you know, award or medal. But man, he's given his life to the military, and he has wounds. Just people don't see them. And, but
just because they're not physically there doesn't mean they're not there, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I hope one day he'll join me on the podcast, but you know, he's got to be comfortable speaking of it, but he's I have a lot of respect for him and yeah, I hate it for people like that too, that just don't, that people don't appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anything in closing, Rob, that you'd like to say?
Gosh, Dad. Thanks for getting a hold of me. It is, you know, truly my honor. A, to be a part of this. B, to know you. C, to you know, to be a part of this, you know, family and friends that you guys have, you know, let me be a part of, every single one of, you know, all the Foresters.
a lot of us. Yeah.
and gosh, it's always, you know, it's a blessing always to tell people that, man, you know, I knew Mark, you know, and it just, you know, I tell people all the time. And I always let people know at the same time too, if you're on Amazon and you buy a book or whatever the case, or if you buy something on Amazon, you can go on Amazon Smile, you can give to the Mark Forrester Foundation. So proceeds and benefits can go straight to the Mark Forrester Foundation. So, you know, people are on Amazon buying all the time, might as well give it to a good foundation, you know?
Thank you. Yeah. Because it doesn't cost them anything.
It doesn't cost them anything, you know? So, again, I just want to say thank you for having me. I very much appreciate it. And, I'm going to continue doing what I can for our guys and take care of our guys, their families, and make sure we're producing the right armor for the job.
Man, thank you. Thanks for doing that, and I appreciate your time very much and your service and dedication to our country and to all of us. By the way, there is one book I'm gonna mention here. It's that book, it's called U.S. Air Force True Stories, Tales of Bravery. And it's funny how somebody found that in their elementary library. And sure enough, within that, there's a section on Mark, and there's a section on you.
Really?
So that's pretty cool. There's two combat controllers in there. And it's great. It's a really good book for elementary or middle school age. And so I think every school library should, or every public library should have it in their arsenal for sure.
Well, I'll check it out and I'll let people know.
Well, thank you, Rob. We'll wrap it up and talk sometime soon.
We will. Thank you again, Thad, for having me.